All right. Give me a count around, Joel.
3, 2, 1.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
I use the bathroom.
Big O! Showtime!
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing Tech Show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll link it bad. For the stroman, go direct to DLNGS.org. And ICChannelsLinuxLink.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 861 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Joel.
Good evening.
We've got Flying Rich.
From the Hughes Compound Southern Command.
And we have Joe. Safe.
Hello, hello.
Yeah. And we have...
Mm-hmm.
What do we have? What do we have? What do we have?
Does he have a microphone?
Who?
Jonas.
I don't know, does
Pat
he?
Stop it, guys.
Hey, what's up, Pat?
Hey, Pat.
Pat's here.
Sorry, gentlemen. I was having some issues.
Glad you can make it in. And it's good that you're here because, Pat, I want to apologize. Last week, when I said, let's start the show, I said, save... you built an AK... Was it AK-47?
Yes.
I said, let's save it for the show. Why don't you talk about it? Because I'd be interested to hear about it.
Okay. Right now?
Yeah, no, go ahead. We just started the show.
Okay.
And, yeah. I didn't want to leave you hanging out there.
Oh, no problem. It's like, I've done AR-15s before, and Rich is on. He's done AR-15s. They're pretty easy, AR-15s. It's like, they're like
it's
Legos.
Just screw it together.
You screw it together. The only thing that's hard on an AR-15 is getting the right torque pounds when you lock down the barrel with the nut. It's basically, you know, a screw that you lock down, a nut that goes around the barrel. So, you know, as long as you have the proper torque per pounds, when you tighten it, you're good. That's about the hardest thing. Like,
No, you're wrong. I'm going to call you out. You're wrong.
Oh, what's harder?
The hardest thing is when you're putting the back plate on and not shooting the detent spring across the room.
Yeah, ARs, they're basically built with pins and springs. That part is definitely true. No,
that's what you call springs. A Jesus spring, right?
I have a question there. Which parts are you actually printing?
Well, we haven't gotten to that. Rich is doing an AR lower for 9mm. The polymer. That's what he's printing. So ARs are pretty easy as far as like doing like if they're good ARs, you can get into them. You could basically do it on your kitchen table pretty easily.
Oh, I've built, you know, an AR lower sitting at my desk in my lap.
Lowers are easy. They're pretty easy. You know, you put the trigger and the hammer springs in with the pins and all that crap. You know, as long as you don't whack yourself with the, you know, the hammer spring, you're okay. That's like the most dangerous thing. You know, AR parts, they're basically built to military specifications. So when a firearm is built to military specifications, you'll have multiple manufacturers building them. And each part has to be exactly the same up to a certain tolerance, and it's very low with ARs. So you can find, back in the day, there was two manufacturers that made ARs, M16s, whatever. You had Colt and you had Bushmaster. You know, fast forward to now, and there's hundreds of companies that make AR parts, and everything pretty much fits. It's pretty much compatible, you know, so you don't have to worry about anything too crazy. They're easy. Okay, switch over to an AK. AKs were designed in 1947, okay, by a bunch of communist peasants, okay, who knew how to do welding for, like, fucking tanks and fucking airplanes and cars. Okay, that's what they were at, okay? ARs, M16s were designed in the 50s by Eugene Stoner, who was an aeronautical engineer who was very forward-thinking. The AKs were done by the Soviets, and it was a much cruder technology involved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, originally the receivers were milled out of a solid piece of metal, and the barrels were screwed in. Okay, that's how they were done. they move ahead to what's called the AKMs, what most people think the AK-47s is actually the AKM. It was a revision several years later. I think it was a 56, if I'm not mistaken. They went to the AKM, and basically what they went from a mill receiver to a stamped metal receiver. It was basically a flat piece of metal that was bent to squares using jigs, okay, and industrial presses. So what they did after that, they have what's called a trunnion. And a trunnion is a forged piece of steel, okay, that holds the barrel in place. So what happens is they push the barrel into the forward trunnion, okay, and they do what's called head spacing. Head spacing is when they use the bolt, the part that interfaces with the round inside the barrel, that locks in when the action is moving, okay, that has to be set perfectly. You know, it's more daunting than what it sounds, but if it's too loose, you'll have rounds going off before they're locked in with the bolt, and you'll that won't be a thing. You'll basically have an explosion next to your face, and then that's not good. So you have to have proper head spacing. The head spacing, you know, you can do it now with they have these metal gauges that show a round when it's good, a go, and a no go. So if it locks properly with the go, and it doesn't lock in with the no-go, you're good. Because what happens is if a barrel loses head space, okay, and you're able to close the no-go gauge, that means your barrel is going and you should not shoot it anymore. So the tech with AKs is a much cruder thing. It's all about riveting and heavy-duty steel cast forged pieces. So it's a little different. So you take a flat receiver that you can either get one that's flat and you do the bending yourself with a jig. Basically, a jig is a piece of metal where you put the flat piece in and then you tighten it up with grease, like anti-seizing grease and screws, and you tighten it up and it will bend the flat into the shape of the receiver. Okay. You can also do what's called an 80%. An 80% is basically a receiver that hasn't been completed. And this can go for an AR 80%, a Glock 80%, or an AK 80%. So when you have an 80%, it's technically not a firearm in the ATF's eyes. So you can mail in an 80% lower receiver through the mail, completely legal, no problems. You don't have to go for an FFL. Once the part has been finished, all the holes have been drilled down, it has to be serialized by the manufacturer. At that point, in the ATF's eyes, that is the firearm. So you could buy a strip lower, AR-15 lower, or an AK lower, or even a Glock, you know, pieces. They consider that part the firearm, it's serialized. Okay, so you can, when you do build, you can go different routes. You can go the 80% route, and it's perfectly legal to finish a build like that yourself. You don't have to have a serial number. The caveat is, if you're going to sell that firearm after you build it with the 80%, you have to have it serialized. Okay, and it's got to go through an FFL challenge if you do a resale of it. If you're just keeping it for yourself, no serial numbers are required. I've done an 80% build also with a Glock pistol. Oh. I have a company called Polymer 80, which are 80% lowers for Glock pistols.
Polymer 80, yeah.
And basically it comes in, it's just a piece of plastic. It looks like a receiver, but there's a whole bunch of you got to drill out the plastic. You got to finish out the process. So they have these jigs that you can walk into either a vise or a drill press, and you drill out so many holes, and you got to drill out a different area. So that's the deal with lowers and receivers, what's an 80% and what's not 80%. I went and I got from a company called Centerfire Systems a bunch of receivers from companies, AK companies, that went out of business, and basically they demilled the guns, they chopped them up. So I got a bunch of receivers really cheap. They're serialized. I had to go for an FFL and do the background check like it was a firearm. But I have several of them. Now, there's also companies that sell parts kits. Mostly Romanian is the most common type. There's a couple different companies. You got like Arms of America. You got Centerfire Systems, Apex Gun Parts, where you can buy a demilled parts kit, an AK parts kit. And it's a rifle that was a military rifle, usually from the 70s or the 80s or even the 90s, that period. Okay, you can get different companies, Bulgarian, Romanian, Hungarian, Russian. Okay, so they're out there, and they vary in price. The Iranians are probably your best bet. You can, if they're starting to dry up now, the prices are starting to go up. I picked up a couple of Iranian kits for like 300-ish. And you get the parts kit, you have to get a receiver, and then you got to get also a new barrel for it. You can either get a foreign-made barrel, or you can get a U.S.-made barrel. You know, purists say, oh, you know, if you get a Romanian parts kit, you should do a Romanian barrel, you know, or Polish barrel, whatever, whatever the parts kit is. But you don't have to. And honestly, the American barrels are actually pretty good. They're nitrated. The old AK barrels were chrome-lined on the inside of the barrels. And that was for when they were automatic versions. And when you have an automatic weapon, a chrome-lined barrel, they used to have really crappy, the Soviets used to have really crappy corrosive ammo. And if you didn't clean it all the time, you would get rust if you didn't have a chrome-lined barrel. So that's why they did the chrome-lined barrels. So the ammo now is better. Even the Russian stuff now is still steel case, but it's actually quite good. It's a lot better than what it used to. I remember years ago, we're talking 20, 30 years ago, I used to get Chinese surplus or Russian surplus ammo, and that stuff was the dirtiest, most corrosive crap, and you would have to clean out your rifle after shooting it. Otherwise, you would start to get rust buildup inside the barrel and whatnot. But that's not so much the case nowadays. So you can get a U.S. nitrated barrel for like 80, 90 bucks, maybe 100 in that range, maybe 100 in range. You can get a foreign-made barrel slightly more, maybe another 10%, 15% more expensive. So you're talking, you know, $80, $90 versus $100, $110. So it's negligible. But if some people that do builds, they want to do a purist build, you know, I want all Romanian parts, you can do that. Or, you know, you got a Hungarian kit, you want a Hungarian barrel, or whatever. Anyhow.
If they were purists, they wouldn't be 3D printing any of it.
Well, you can't do 3D printing with AKs, except maybe handguards and that kind of stuff. I don't think there's any 3D printing going
on. There's the Plastikoff.
I've never seen that. Is that a real thing?
Yeah. Check Brandon Herrera's channel, the AK guy.
Oh, he's terrible, Brandon. He's a good guy.
Oh my gosh.
Two or three years ago, there was a guy that put out a YouTube video of printing 3D pistol, or 3D printing pistols.
Defense Distributed, yeah.
Getting, we had him on the show. When he finally got it over like 500 rounds, and then when he finally got it over like 1,000 rounds fired before it fell apart.
Yeah, you're still going to need a steel barrel at the very
least. Of course.
There's, you know, if first off, hey, Pat, I never knew you could transfer a homemade firearm. I thought it was...
You got to serialize it.
Okay, because, you know, I've actually, a friend has, I don't know if you should do... Anyhow, I have purchased many AR-15 80% lowers, and I used a ghost gunner from that guy. And machined them out. It's just stupid cool. Very easy to do. The Polymer 80, I actually got to send them back. I have two Polymer 80 AR-15 lowers that I guess they pulled them out of the mold, or they're still hot when they pulled them out of the mold. The buffer tube didn't align correctly, so they wouldn't operate. But they're good about it. They're like, hey, just, you know, show us a picture of them both bent up, and we'll send you new ones. The Brandon Herrera did a thing on the Plastikoff. He shot that. And actually, Pat is famous because Brandon Herrera sent Pat a message.
It wasn't just him. It was also Mr. Guns and Gear and a few other people, which is very cool.
Yeah, so I was at the Iraq Veteran shoot, and I had everybody...
The YouTube gun people. There's a bunch of channels.
So I made sure all of the popular guys said, hey, Pat, we miss you. Wish you were here.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Not for much longer, I guess, huh? Who knows?
So, Pat, do you have like a Harbor Freight press? How are you bending up the flats?
Well, I haven't done any flats. What I've done is, like I said, I got the emailed receivers from Centerfire Systems, and they're mostly IO, which was a company in Florida who went out of business, and DDI, which is a company in Tennessee that went out of business. So I've got like receivers that are like pretty much done. The only thing you have to do with them is bolt in the front trunnion.
So bolt in or rivet in?
Rivet.
Okay.
Yeah, so you got to do riveting. So that's the main thing. You're going to need probably three things. You're going to need a shot press. You can get one from Harbor Freight for about $100. And the reason for that thing is the barrel is held in with a pin. So you can buy a kit that's what's called populated already. There's three things on the barrel that go in the barrel. The barrel goes into the front trunnion. And then you have the rear sight leaf, you have the gas port, and then you have the front sight. And then you have some newer designs from the Russians and the Polish and some Bulgarians where they've combined the gas port and the front sight into one piece now. Okay, you can buy a kit that's already populated that has all those pieces on there. If you don't, you're going to need to put them on there and populate it, and that involves putting them on straight and then drilling out holes for the pin to go through. It's all held in the pins. So you may need drill bits for the proper pin sizes that you're going to drill if you don't get a pre-populated kit. My first build that I just did was the Romanian on the folder, and that one had the barrel already populated. So when you got a populated kit like that, what you need to do is you need to knock out the barrel pin, and you need to shop press to do that. It's a lot of pressure, pushes down. So you remove the pin, the barrel pin, and then you need some kind of a barrel ram to push out the barrel from the trunnion. And it's a lot of pressure, so you need a shop press to push in and push out those pins. Once you have the pins pushed out, you're going to need some kind of a riveted mechanism to put the rivets in. Now, I watched this one dude on YouTube who was a builder, and the guy is an airplane mechanic, and he does riveting by hand with hand rivets. And I can't do that. So what you can do, there are companies that supply rivet jaws that go with the bolt cutters that you buy at Harbor Freight for like $25. And the rivets go from anywhere between 60 and 70. One is like Top Tools, or you can go on akbuilder.com. They have a couple different companies where you can get the rivet jaws. And basically what you do is you buy the bolt cutters from Harbor Freight, and then you remove the cutter jaws, and then you put those rivet jaws on there. And you're going to use that to do your rivets for your trunnions. There are some other rivets that you might need, like if you have a receiver that doesn't have a side plate mounted for an optic, and you want to go that route, then you're going to have to drill holes into the receiver for the side mount plate for the optics.
Pat, don't get me wrong, because I'm with you lockstep all the way. If you add it all up, and I'm just saying this for the audience, so if you buy the bolt cutter, the rivet jaws, the press, the jigs, I mean, you're probably already more than what you could get an AK for.
It doesn't make, this is the deal with AKs. AKs used to be ridiculously cheap back in the day. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, you can get a Chinese AK for about $250, okay? And the Russians were more expensive, the Bulgarians were more expensive, the Hungarians were more expensive. The Romanians were closer to the lower end. Okay, nowadays, the cheapest AK you get is going to run you about $800.
Thank God I bought that AK when I was with you for $450.
Right, you got a Romanian underfolder, right? That wasn't
yep.
long. Yeah. What year was that? That was like, what, 2010-ish?
Yeah, I don't even remember when. You know,
somewhere around
when I went
2010.
To the gun show.
So you got it right before they shot up. So that AK is worth about what it's worth when you bought it, roughly.
And I hate to say it, the intrinsic value isn't there. I mean, that's a $400 gun all day long to me in my mind.
Yes, but like I said, you can buy that gun now and it's going to run you about $800.
But so, now you can fix it whenever you have a problem, though.
You don't
yeah,
have
but I can fix an AR.
Yeah, well, so let's go to the price. So if you're going to do just one build, it's not worth it. If you're going to do a bunch of builds, then it's worth it to go and get the tools that you're going to need to do. So
now, there used to be guys that got together and they would do a build party, but the ATF kind of got frowned upon.
You still can. There's some builders that do it. Like, remember that show, American Guns? The guy who got locked up for being a pedophile? Right?
Oh, Red Jacket, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. Red Jacket Farms was a company down in who were they, Monroe or
Baton Rouge? No, not Monroe. What's
Baton Rouge
big town?
Somewhere?
Baton Rouge, yeah.
Yeah, they're from the Baton Rouge area. And there was a bunch of guys on that show besides the asshole guy who got locked up who were normal people and were actually very good people. and Joe Moe's one, and then I've actually met Joe.
I should have got a picture with him.
The gunsmith guy has his own shop now. I forget his name.
Yeah,
he does
Backless Defense.
No, that's Joe Moe, Backless Defense. He built AR parts and like compressors. The other guy, the fat guy, who's
really?
Black, the gunsmith. I forget his name. The beard and the tattoos. I forget his name. Anyhow, he has a company down there, and he does builds. And it's expensive. It's not cheap. I looked into it. There are some companies that you can do it. The other thing you could do is you do, what's the company out in Vegas? He does builds, but it's super expensive class. You could go out there for like 3, 4, 5 days, whatever it is, and you take the class and you do the build with him, but it's pretty expensive. It's over like $1,000, not including the gun parts. So anyhow, we're talking about the price. Like these kits, you can get an unpopulated barrel kit for like, you know, the whole kit for like 300 plus the barrel, it's going to run you about $4. Or you can get a populated kit, a little more, like five and change. So that saves you a lot of work if you get a pre-populated barrel, it's been headspaced already. So the first one, I went that route, and I paid a little more money. So I'm in like maybe 500, but the gun is done, it's worth about 800 now. This next build I'm doing, I'm going to do a much cruder build. I drilled the barrel up, pin in. I'm going to populate it and do everything. That one I spent about $350. So after I'm done with that, I'm going to have a rifle that's worth about $800, $900 too. So, you know, any cheap EA kit would run you about $800. It's bizarre. Like back in the day, AKs were super cheap and ARs were super expensive. I think my first AR, I wanted to get a Colt, but they were too damn expensive back in the late 80s. They were like $1,000 back then.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So I went and I got a Bushmaster. My dad like gave me half the money for it, and I bought a Bushmaster, which was cheaper. And I had that rifle for years and years, and I shot the shit out of it. And they were good, the old Bushmasters. But nowadays, you can get an AR for like $450, $500 for like a Palmetto State Armory.
If you're a savvy shopper, you can do an AR for $350.
Yeah, you can do your build yourself. But so they basically flipped the prices. AKs are now expensive. Part of that's because of importation bans. The only countries that we're bringing in AKs nowadays are Poland, Romania, Serbia, I think. No more Russian, no more Chinese. You used to get old German kits. I think there's some Hungarians you could still get. So, you know, the kits are starting to dry up, but you can still get Romanians, you can still get Poles. The Polish are really nice. Don't get me wrong. I have a Polish rifle, WBP, and that's real nice. I really like the Polish, and I also like the Serbians too. The Zatava, those are great. I mean, if you don't want to build and just buy an AK, I highly recommend either for Polish WBP. They're very good. I like them a lot. Or Zatava Arms, which is the Serbians. You can get like a pistol for like $700-$800. You can get the rifles for like $900. You know. But they're very well made. I really like the Serbian AKs. They're very well built. Very impressed by them, and the Polish too. So you can still get a low-end Romanian for like $800. So if you don't want to do the build right, you can buy. Palmetto's also making AKs now too. Supposedly they're decent.
Oh yeah.
I haven't shot it, but the reviews are good on them.
Well, Palmetto is making, or they're making the AKV, which is a 9mm AK, and they're coming out with an MP5 clone.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to be. I have an MP5, and I shoot MP5s, and they're really good there.
So,
they're awesome. I love MP5s.
And I know we're kind of geeking out on guns. MP5 is cool. It shoots 9mm, has a 30-round mag, and it's a roller-delayed blowback system. That's the action, how it operates.
Right, that's the H&K family.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after World War II, the Germans were banned from building anything. So what happened was a bunch of their gun manufacturer people, their engineers, they went over to Spain, which was fascist at the time, and they were friendly to the old German Nazis. And they had a government agency called CETME, and they basically built that system, which became the H&K system.
I love Jonas's comment. He says, what distro can you run on it?
an AK is probably Debian or Slackware.
Yeah.
An AR is probably Ubuntu. I think that's a good analogy.
Pretty much.
An H&K is probably Fedora.
So,
what no arch?
Now, I've printed actually as
print,
I actually
if you can print a gun. That's probably arch.
I'm out so, then.
There's actually I've got a couple of versions of the 9mm lower that I printed. So it's an AR-9.
AR lower.
So as opposed to like an AR-15, this shoots a 9mm round more like an MP5. It takes a Glock mag, and the Glock mags, I've actually printed some Glock mags also. So the Glock mags are 33 rounds. Somebody came up with an AR-15 design that uses a U-bolt around the buffer tube, so it's stronger. And I grafted that end, you know, basically neither design is my own, but I did a hybrid. I took two people's designs. I did some customized beefing up, but I added that U-bolt in the rear, and if we're doing YouTube, I couldn't show it to you either, but it's an inch away from me right now, and I still haven't gotten to the range yet, so I'm totally itching. I guess maybe Friday or Saturday I'll head out to the range and see if my AR-9 holds up.
Cool. Yeah, like, so if you get the populated AK kit, it's basically the whole front end already done. The only thing you're going to have to do is knock out the barrel pin, push out the barrel, and then rivet in the front trunnion to the receiver. And then you push, once you have the front trunnion riveted in, you go to push the barrel back in, make sure that the hole that was drilled for the barrel pin is lined up, and then you're going to push the barrel pin. And then once you do that, your gun is pretty much done. So
I love the term trunnion. It makes it sound like it's all sorts of special. Really, it's
like
just a block of metal with holes in it.
Yeah, it's a heavy cast steel cast part. Basically, you know, when they went from the mill receiver to the stamp receiver, the costs were lowered a lot. Like this AK, the mill, like there's some old Polish. The Israeli deal, which is a 5.56 AK variant, which is excellent. I have one of those, and they're fucking great rifle. That's milled. So there are some milled. There were some Chinese ones that were early back in the 80s that were around. It's just an older design. That was the original design. And then they went to the stamp fever design. It was just cheaper and easier to do, more cost effective. And they had these factories pulled up and just, you know, cranking them out by the millions.
All right, so Pat, I got to ask you, what's the most expensive firearm you own?
Let me think. MP5 is up there. I have a Tika bolt action precision.
Wait. All right, so what'd you pay for the MP5?
I have an Omega. I think it was $1,500 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And that was a deal. They've gone up. They're closer to
$2,000
now, MP5s.
So the actual most expensive gun I have is the FN57. That was $1,200 when I got it. And the second most expensive is I got the Kel-Tec RFD.
I also have a Tika Precision, the XTX3 whatever. It's the full.
What's that chambered in?
Mine's in 308. They come in 6.5 Creedmoor too. My brother has one in 6.5, and those. I paid like $15 for that one, just the rifle. And then you get a rifle that's as precise as that. Like, I can shoot quarter MOA groups at 100 yards.
So for people that don't know what that means, MOA is minute of angle. So meaning at 100 yards, his rounds are deviating a quarter of an inch.
Yeah, so basically you go through the same hole and shoot them through at 100 yards. And that's excellent. An AR... is very accurate for like a semi-auto. We're talking one MOA. AKs tend to be a little not as bad as good unless you get a really good barrel. They average 2 to 3 MOA at 100 yards with iron sights. So ARs, you know, I love them all. You know, they're like all different kinds. Guns are cool. I like all different kinds. You know, I like AKs, I like ARs, I like H&K variants. I like bolt guns. They're all cool. You know, they have an appeal to them all. But
it's kind of like women in shoes.
Yes.
So, all right, I'm sorry if we're going like crazy on gun. Pat, I kind of categorize guns into, you know, practical, like you have different purposes for them, and then I categorize guns into, like, unicorn guns. So I consider, like, my PS90, my FN57, I got the Ruger 57, and the RFB as unicorn guns. Do you agree or disagree in what
I'm
doing?
Sure, like, I have a DeVore, but DeVore is a unicorn gun. You know, the Styrog is a unicorn gun.
Oh yeah, I hate the Styrog. I want one. Just hate it.
The Tavor's cool.
So I shot a Styrog, and gosh, who's the guy? Why can't I think of his name? I got his picture in my face, right? Face in my mind.
Die Hard?
No. He lives up north. God, you're gonna laugh at me when I can't remember his name. But he's got a mustache and a beard. You know, he's got the tactical facial hair going on. And he shot the Steyr left-handed. You know, it's a rightward ejecting bullpup. So I did that also. I got two rounds out, and I had crescent-shaped cuts in my upper lip because Mac, Military Arms Channel, Tim.
Yeah, he's from, I think he's in Indiana. But he's originally from Canada.
Yeah, he's in Indiana. And so I wrote Tim, I'm like, yeah, Tim, you can't do that without the tactical facial hair.
Yeah, so, you know, they're all good. But these AKs, if you do your own build, you're basically doubling price by finishing the build yourself.
So it just price-wise, my AR-9, there was some miscellaneous hardware, and we're talking probably under $5 for the U-bolt and the bolt that I used, a quarter-inch bolt and a wing nut that I used as pins.
Right.
The lower maybe cost me $10 worth of plastic and a few cents worth of electric. The upper, I think I got with the bulk carrier for like $300.
We use cool. ABS.
No, I printed in PETG.
Okay.
I gotta get into the 3D printing stuff.
Right? Oh, all right. Cool. So I forgot one thing. So no, it didn't cost me $300. There was a lower build kit. So the trigger group, the grip, the buffer tube, and the buffer in the spring. So that was probably, you know, like $75. But I had that kicking around. So usually, like, if you want to buy an AR-9, they're $650. They start at $650, and that's like the best.
I did my own build for about $4 and change.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I could go on another couple of hours about guns. So I
you
don't know if that
talk about them forever,
stuff.
But yeah, let's get
yeah,
let's
if you
try
wanted
and
to
move
build,
on.
If you wanted to build, I'd say start with ARs or a Glock aftermarket support kit, like an 80%.
So, and I'll pip my stuff. I got an AR build. If you go to gunstreamer.com, look up Flying Rich. I have a video 4th of July AR build, and I go through, you know, all of the steps. If you have any questions, hit me up. I'll fill you in.
Lots of fun. I like guns. I've been shooting for my whole life. I liken them to guitars and basses. You know, I appreciate the craftsmanship and engineering that goes into it. They're fun to hold and play, you know, and they're very similar, you know, the whole mentality. You know,
it's like if I got anything similar to that would be knives.
Knives is a whole other thing. I mean,
yeah, I'm not a knife geek. I've got like one or two, and that's about it.
Like, yeah. most of the gun guys I know have bougie knives that are like $500. I mean, I'm
buying
the $20
knife.
Yeah.
You don't
even
need
that.
Kershaw's a good knife.
Well, depending on what, I wouldn't get the Kershaw Shuffle. That's weight, you know. Or so some Kershaws are made in the U.S., some Kershaws are made in China. Kershaw does have a higher end line. The Kershaw Shuffle, I just would not buy. I wouldn't advise anyone to buy. I've got a.
I'm gonna say
Kershaw.
Most knives are probably made in China now.
A lot.
Well, they have Kershaw has lines that are made in the U.S. and lines that are made in China. The Kershaw Weston is a decent $20-ish knife. And I hate to say it, I basically want to go on a monthly subscription, just get one a month, and so when I do something stupid with it and break it, I don't care.
You know, it's ironic. Some of my favorite knives are actually some of my cheapest knives. Like my daily is a Schrade that I carry. It's a folder that I carry. I have one that Link so kindly gave me. which I don't even remember what brand it was. It's some off brand of like $6 probably on Amazon, and it's actually pretty nice too, with the Tanto blade. When I look at knives now, I either want something that's unique and has something that what I have doesn't have. Like, for example, if I had one with a nice handle on it or something like that, I don't really have right now, like a nice horn handle or something like that, or a blade or something that it can do that my other ones can't. Something that I'm kind of interested in, so that kind of collecting knives kind of deal. I now, and the nice thing with knives is they don't take up a lot of space. So I think the one I have, the one Link sent me, was an Oerka or Oerla. I don't know. I can't
quite
tell the name.
Like, yeah, I have a couple, you know.
So
this one's nice because it has like
bayonets.
The flipper.
Bayonets are cool.
Yeah.
No. There's only one cool bayonet, and that's the bayonet you get with your Mos Negan.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool bayonets. The AK bayonets.
The Mos Negan bayonet you can use to roast marshmallows and be like 4 feet away from the fire.
Also known as the shit stick. That's a Brandon, no, not Brandon, the other guy, James Reeves, he calls it a shit stick. I have one, I know what they're like. I take a Mauser any day of that.
Oh yeah, yeah. But look, you gotta have a Mosin.
Yeah, they're kind of low end.
But anyway. I hate to say it, the price of that's gone up. You know, it used to be
cheap. Like $79, now they're like $400.
Oh my god. No, that's a gun that's absolutely not worth $400.
No, it's not. Even the Mausers have gone up. Like, I have a Swedish Mauser that was made in 1905 that was converted to like a hunting rifle. And I think I paid maybe $150 for it like 30 years ago, and now they're like $500. And these are old guns. They're all over 100 years old.
Yep.
They're just well made.
Mm-hmm. That's what I keep telling my son. It's like, you know, he like when something starts to go wrong with his car, I'm like, he's like, oh, it's time to buy a new car. I'm like, dude, it's just a battery, okay?
Time to buy a new car? Oh man, he's jonesing for it.
Yeah, in fact, I actually just looked up. We did replace the battery in that, and the cheapest battery, and this is on Advanced Auto Parts website. The cheapest battery they had that would fit our cruise was $89, and the most expensive is about $200. They're averaging between $100 to $150.
Joel, the batteries are exactly the same. The cheapest battery you can get, and the difference is the kind of warranty that you get with the battery.
Right, warranty or the how many cold cranking amps they can produce. Max, you know, that those are maximums. You're not going, like, if you take a 600 CCA battery and try and crank it at 600 CCA all the time, it's not going to last very long.
Well, and that's ideal temperatures also.
Correct. So, and honestly, you don't need, it's not one of those things where if you have more CCAs, it's better. No, you need the minimum to start your car. That's really all you need.
So the bad thing was the truck battery was going flat just because nobody was driving it during the COVID.
Yeah, I actually think that helped accelerate that, because there would be a couple of days where he wouldn't drive, but maybe once a week. So, you know, I'm sure that didn't help, but. And it's amazing how, in modern cars, how little things can be all fixed by a battery. Like, some things, like, I have them carry a jump pack in the car. We have, like, one of those FatMax jump packs that you plug into the wall and charge, and you can jump the car right off of that instead of a set of jumper cables, and that way you're not dependent on anybody else. I highly recommend putting one of those in the back of your car if you got one.
I can't figure out how to make them work, and the two that we have somehow didn't work.
Really interesting.
Yeah. I
don't go for the ones. There's some that will say you can jump your car by plugging between two cars cigarette light.
Oh no, Lord no! All right,
that sounds like a terrible idea.
There's a jump pack that will actually do that claims to actually do that, and I'm like, no, don't.
Let me give you one word of advice, like jumper cables. Jumper cables
thick.
Should be heavy, not thick, and I'll tell you why not thick. Because the cheapy jumper cables, it's like speaker wire, it's like mouse wire,
yeah,
but with, you know, a sausage of rubber around it that's cheap. You know, the copper filament is what costs the money. So when you get jumper cables, if you don't know, like if they're just fat, every jumper cable's fat. It's not going to look like speaker
wire.
You got to look at the end where it's clamped into the clips. And if you see a honking amount of copper there, and it's heavy as a mother, then you know you got good jumper cables. Otherwise, you're buying the cheapies, and the cheapies ain't going to do it.
Yeah, high gauge. You know, you don't want to...
lower the gauge, the
actually, you're
the
right. It's yeah. Sorry, you're right. Correct. But yeah, you want the fatter cables. You don't want.
That's what she said.
Light. Yeah, that's right. But you know, but it's like, you know, I remember when out the door you can get a battery replaced. You know, as in you don't have to do the work for $80. It's not the case anymore. I mean, it's just. Even if you buy one, and I mean, granted. Like, if you go buy it at an AutoZone or something, generally they will drop it in for you for nothing. But I also tell you, don't trust the stupid little tester the AutoZone guy has, because he tested ours and says, oh, it's fine.
Okay,
he just had a voltmeter, that's all it was.
See, people don't know how to use those testers. A real tester puts a load on. It actually, it's like chrome and looks like a toaster and it has a heating element.
Correct.
So the one
AutoZone had was a little hand one, you know, so that's BS. Don't go there.
So when you're diagnosing a charging system on a car, the proper way to diagnose a battery is charge the battery overnight, don't do anything, and do the tester. Of course, nobody can do that because they don't have the tester at their own home.
Correct.
So, they probably don't have a charger either.
Ideally, that's...
I always do it the slow way.
So, but
sorry,
like,
continue on, Rich. I'm sorry.
It's amazing that when your battery's starting to go out, the little things that will also kind of go out at the same time too, like the outside temperature sensor. Who'd have thunk that would, you know, we jumped it and they drove it from here to Lowe's, and when they got back, said the outside temperature is not showing. I'm like, well, first off, why do you care? Second off,
roll down the
window. Yeah. Well, that's fixed now too. So a bunch of little things, and they did. You know, I have to say that my dealership, you know, they did a good job. There's very few dealerships that will charge you what I would call a fair price. I would say that I was happy with what I paid. Yes, it was over $200, but I don't care. With all the other stuff I had them do, it was worth it. Because I had him do a whole bunch of little things just to make sure that my son was happy. So, but one of these days I do need to look at another. I keep telling the wife I kind of want a fun car for the next car, because I'm approaching 50 and I'm like, you know,
time to get a fun car.
I think so myself. Like, I wouldn't mind my now. Granted. Only if the fun car isn't your only car, all right? So what I would probably do is get the fun car and keep what we have.
Wait, Joel, what's a fun car to you?
Like a Corvette.
What kind of Corvette you want?
2020.
Seriously, man? You're talking about a C8?
Yeah, C8, yeah.
Joel! Now, do you make over $200,000 a year? How much do you make?
He makes $250,000 a year. Come on.
The C8 actually is depending on what you see. That's the other thing too. The C8s are
base model C8 $60,000 if you can get it at that cost.
Right, which is actually only 10 grand more than my Traverse, to be honest. Well, we paid about 50 for the Traverse, so.
What?
Yeah. Now, dude. Granted, I didn't pay 50 for it. That was the sticker, but the thing about the C8 too, you know, one of the things that always used to be on Corvettes is, do you want a convertible or do you want the hardtop? Well, and it really doesn't matter with the C8 because the straight stock C8 is a T-top, so it's essentially the same thing as a convertible. You just have to manually take it off. Now that the convertible one, yeah.
The 2020 Stingray is pretty.
Oh, yes, it's pretty.
I don't want to get it though. But it doesn't really compare to the 1969 Corvette Stingray.
Oh, I'll agree with that too. But you know, now style wise, you know, now I'll say performance wise, no way. But
so
you know.
does the infotainment system run Linux though? That's the big question. Is it automotive Linux?
I don't know if my
if I had a 1969 Stingray, yes, it would run
that's
Linux.
What I'm gonna say, yeah. So that's Joel, a fun car, a Camaro, preferably the Roadster Camaro, the convertible top would be awesome. Another fun car and a whole lot cheaper, and would also require me getting a motorcycle endorsement would be the Polaris Slingshot.
I don't think I would ever drive own a Camaro.
I would for sure.
Just because,
pretty sweet.
Like, everybody had a Camaro when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So like, here's the reason I wouldn't get the 2020. Like, I would lease it, but I wouldn't get the 2020 Camaro because the next, you know, the 2021 or the 22 are going to come out with some real hot models. So I would definitely, you know, if I had a company to lease it on, I would do it and then dump it. You know, same thing with the Toyota Supra, or I should say the BMW.
Yeah, it's not happening anytime soon for me. And that's the other thing, too, nowadays. If you just want a car, you know, you don't want a crossover that or an SUV, that's kind of what you're going to have to do is get into something like that because there really is no, like, you know, like, another one I would have, if I could actually find one, would qualify as a fun car would be the Chevrolet SS, which they stopped making them. I think 2017 was last year they made those, which is essentially a Holden from Australia they brought over here, and that is very underrated. It didn't sell well here. But it has a it's basically as good as some of the BMW sedan, performance sedans. So, I mean, it's that good. Everyone that I've ever seen that's actually test drove one on YouTube, like DeMuro and a few of the others, you know, they all really liked it, but apparently nobody else did. You know, that's the funniest thing with that SS. And those are... You probably get one of those between 40 and 50, I would think. Maybe 45. So, I mean, they actually probably the last great American sedan that will come in a full manual. Because that's the other thing about the 2020 Corvette is there is no manual option. They're all automatics.
So
double-clutch automatics.
Back in the day, I was working at a Porsche dealership, not a dealership, Porsche repair shop, when the Tiptronics came out. And the Tiptronics were good. I mean, it's not like the PDK dual clutch technology, but the Tiptronic was a great system. I didn't think it was any slouch.
Well, now a lot of cars have that too. I mean, you know, it might not be called Tiptronic, but it's the same concept as the Tiptronic.
Yeah, you know, the VW, Porsche, Audi line all have the Tiptronics in one form or another. But I'll tell you what, I don't mind driving the clutch on the highway, but around town, it's maddening.
Yep.
And in
yep.
my first plane crash, I injured my left knee, so it does act up every once in a while.
I like how he says that. His first plane crash.
Yeah.
His first.
You gotta specify.
If you had more than one. but yeah, I mean, but like the Slingshot, it would be pure fun because I'd only get to drive it maybe 3 months out of the year.
Unless you live in Florida, then you drive it all but 5 days a year.
I was going to say that, yeah. Because there's no... Well, actually, I take it back. There is a roof option on it, but there's no windshield. Not much of a windshield to speak of. And you would have to want to wear a helmet the whole time you're riding it, too. Cause,
do you know how to tell a happy motorcycle driver? From the bugs in his teeth.
Bugs in the teeth, yeah. Yeah. But, and actually, another fun vehicle in the same realm, and I don't care what it says about me, is the Spider.
The Spider is a nice vehicle.
Yep. Or the Riker, but the Spider is a little bit more comfortable than the Riker. It's why can't I remember the company?
See, BRP. I would absolutely consider a Corvette. Love the idea. I do like the idea of the Supra. I like turbo cars because you can always crank them up.
BRP, Can-Am Spider, that's what it is.
The one of my Halo cars is like a Porsche Cayman, but again, I like a mid-engine car. I've driven 916s, and they were a lot of fun. You know, being in a totally neutral drift with a 50-50 weight split is pretty awesome.
The Taycan would be, I think it's the Porsche Taycan, I think that one would be pretty sweet to have too. Is that a, I think it's a Porsche hybrid. Yeah.
Wait, is it hybrid or all electric?
I think it's a hybrid.
And of course, I haven't gotten a ride in it. I got a ride in Hank's old car. He had an Audi R8, the V10 Plus, and he's got an older, he traded in that car, well, Lemon lawed it. He got an older one, V10, and he had it tuned.
Yeah, the Taycan is a plug-in hybrid, I believe. And a sedan.
And it stink crazy fast.
It definitely is. So,
So anybody got any Linux technology to talk about? I feel like I'm like deceptive marketing.
It's almost too much, like I don't want to talk about work because I actually have to start learning Git.
There's nothing to learn.
Well,
you have to learn what? What did you say you had to learn?
Jenkins.
Jenkins.
Oh, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jenkins.
Yep.
You know what? It's not that hard and it's not that easy.
Yeah, and Ansible. So, yeah.
Ansible's pretty cool. You know what? Ansible's pretty straightforward. Jenkins is a bastardized version of Groovy that you'll be pulling your hair out.
All right.
Things that you have.
How
to
do you say Ansible and Jenkins? Because there's two different. Jenkins is different than Ansible. Ansible is orchestration. Jenkins, you can do testing and deployment.
Right. We're going to be deploying a lot of things from Ansible, but
they're not necessarily related. I was just saying Ansible is pretty straightforward.
And for the people. For the geeks that aren't full-blown geek that don't know the language, could somebody explain what Ansible and Jenkins is for the crowd out there?
Do you want to do it, Joel, or should I?
You're probably going to get it more right than I will.
All right, so Jenkins is a continuous integration tool that allows you to automate testing and the middleware between... like your development environment and taking that to production. That's what we use right now is Jenkins. So that I've talked about in the past controls that whole thing from when you do a PR to GitHub against a master branch. Jenkins tests it and then takes that when it's merged into the master branch and builds the container that we use and pushes that out into the development environment and staging environment by default, and then when we're ready to deploy to production, it is the work that it's a consistent tool that you build everything you want to do in Jenkins, and it does it on a consistent basis,
right?
You know, because it's in there. Now Ansible is.
So,
go ahead.
But yeah, one other definition, continuous integration for the people that don't know.
So continuous integration is a method by which you're going to take your software and your development of your software that when it's ready to take it through its testing and then deployment process, right. However far you want to do that. So it's you write all that stuff and design it inside of a tool like Jenkins, and then it just continuously performs those steps whenever right. certain criteria are met. So,
and then you deploy the testing, then you deploy the production if it goes to test okay.
So. All right, can I just add a little interjection in here?
Go ahead.
So continuous integration as opposed to doing releases and deployments. So typically how we did it when I was at Cornell is you would check in your code if you're doing test-driven development. So if it passed the test, it would then check into the repository and then get deployed to the dev server. And so you're constantly, you know, maybe you're still having releases of your code to production, but it's doing continuous integration into your dev environment. So you write code to a testing standard. You're like,
right.
for my code to properly work, it has to pass these tests.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Dave.
Hey, yeah,
oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And we're doing things like with us, with our full GitOps chain, we're using Cloudable, I think. And we're doing things like we have a ASR, for example, we have a monitoring, like say a monitoring detects that, oh, listeners become unresponsive or something like that, or servers become unresponsive. Then the ASR will then take over and either reboot the server or if you have enough intelligence built into your service recovery, it'll recover the service. So we're doing things like that with like for example, we're gonna have ASR restart there's some processes that our clients will use. One's basically a job scheduling through what we call the process handler. Another is EDQM, or there's a we have a transaction kind of system called EDX, which essentially is based on triggers. So, for example, a student changes their name, there might be a trigger that sends that name change up to one of our other applications. Okay, so that's called EDX. So, and that has its own process. It's always resonant in memory and running all the time. So, and then there's a garbage collection process that we have running, and we're gonna have the service recovery do that through ASR. And so it's learning how to do that kind of automation. Like in our case, we're probably gonna do a lot with Jenkins. It's not necessarily developing new software, deploying new software with Jenkins, but we might like, for example, create a script that will go in and clean up the logs or something like that, and we'll schedule that via Jenkins, and it's automated so that we don't have to do that. So and other things of that nature. So I mean, there's we're kind of just scratching the surface of it. Like we had a scrum earlier this week, and I'm like watching the whole thing, and I'm like, okay, that's nice. Now how am I gonna do this? We're gonna have a confab, like starting next week. We're gonna have a weekly just our team, because the person leading this other scrum in our department is looking at one of the other ERPs, which isn't the one our team works on. So, which is always the case in our cases, because the other ERP has more clients, they are farther ahead with that kind of automation than we are. But we're getting there. We want to do some more automations like that. We also want to do things. We're going to work on some scripts that do things like looking for stall processes so that they can either alert us and we can then alert the client, or we can take care of the process. Like if a end users stuck. Like, for example, they logged in, brought up a record, and then walked off and went to lunch, you know, but then somebody else is trying to run a batch process and now it's choking on that person, then we need to work on figure out a way how to kill that process so that we can continue on their life. So, but just more automation through Jenkins and Ansible for a lot of our upgrades. We're going to start using Ansible for more of those upgrades. And we got our big project is AWS modernization and taking clients, our Linux clients, off of RHEL 6 and on the RHEL 7. So that'll be interesting. And controlling more of their access to. So, for example, right now
it's causing Joel to fall asleep.
It is, actually. It's not exciting.
You know what, Rich?
But I have to learn it.
Rich, you also were asking what is Ansible, and Ansible is a look at it as software defined.
Typically, it's
server.
An orchestration tool.
Yeah, orchestrate. You're right. Orchestration, kind of like Chef. Ansible has playbooks. Chef has cookbooks, where you define in software how you want a server to be built.
Correct. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah,
we're using it to build like Tomcat installations and stuff like that, so that once the Ansible playbook runs, not only is it installed, but it's hopefully has some base tuning done to Tomcat.
It should be completely configured and ready to go right out of the box to launch your application, and you can then use that repeatedly and consistently to continuously deploy your services into your production. Into all your environments, for that matter.
Right. And the only problem right now is, I don't know how we're going to deal with this. Whether we have one centralized Ansible server for all of our clients, or if each client's going to get their own Ansible server that we deploy.
So you
have
Ansible your Ansible servers.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know how we're doing that yet, because I know that the way the other ERP, each client has their own Ansible server, I think. Not sure. I'm not sure if that's true, but I think that might be the case. Because remember, our typical client's going to have, at least in our case, if it's depending on what if they're Linux, they have two app servers, which both run the Unidata database on them. Then they're going to have one UI box for production, one for non-production. They're going to have one at least one API box for non-production, probably two for production, two self-service front ends for production, one self-service for non-production. And those are all Windows machines because that's what it runs on. Then you have our outgoing product, which is WebAdvisor, which runs on Apache Tomcat, and Java. We're using OpenJDK now, thankfully. No more Oracle Java, because the Oracle's license changes. So, and those are all Windows boxes, and that doesn't even count the reporting box, which runs SAP Business Objects. So, you know, our typical client may have anywhere between 20 to 30 servers, depending on how much, you know, what their loads are, if they're SQL or if they're Unidata. So, and then they have their own customization. See, my department, we have set, our product is also available in a SaaS form, which means no customizations. In our case, that's not the case for our clients. Our clients have customizations, their own custom integrations and stuff like that that they do. So, and we assist them with. So, automation. We got to automate things so that we remove the error. And one of the things I'd love to automate that I'm not so sure we can is what we call cloning an environment. So, by cloning, in our case, cloning isn't cloning all the servers, it's more cloning the data. So we'll take a copy of the application binaries from the app server, and if it's a SQL client, we also back up and restore the database, and then we run a clone wizard through a tool we call SAVLA, and the question is how do we automate the running of that tool, which is a graphical tool? So yes, I'm hoping that we can get it to the point where we basically can press a button once we have the copies in place and have it do it, so that it's done properly. Like this week, I had one of the other admins did a clone, and ooh, they put the listener on one of the wrong servers. So I'm like, so I had to fix that. That's the thing that automation can save you from. You know, your automation, you set that all up in automation before it actually does it. And then you have the chance at that point to review all the settings that you want in the automation. And then once the automation does it, it's going to do exactly what you tell it to. Hopefully. And then you hopefully would be able to test it at some point, but in this particular case, you probably wouldn't be able to. You would just have to get another copy and redo it again. Because essentially what we're talking about here is non-production environments that we're building. So from a copy of production data. So, but we got to learn all that stuff because that's the mantra. Is to remove the human element as much as we can, because, and it's not so much that we can, it's because we're replacing ourselves, at least not yet, but it's more like if we get more clients, how are we going to keep up our current workload, you know?
Oh, yeah, you're not replacing yourself. You're going to be replacing the monotony of tasks with a whole slew of new challenges that you're going to have to solve.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
DevOps, GitOps, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. It's a joy. It really is. It's fun. It's a challenge. It's, you know, to make things simpler on the front end, you know, how that all happened, it gets very complex on the back end to tie all these things together.
Yep. Well, and it also goes to that too, whereas one of the other things that's driving us is pushing, I mean, yes, our clients will still have some custom code here, but as much as possible, we got to make it so that our clients' systems more or less look the same. Even if their code's custom, the paths to where the code typically exists is still the same. The names of the environments are the same. And things that, as much as possible, our standards are the same across all the boxes. If they're not, your automation's going to fail. Because if the directory doesn't exist on your box, you expect it to exist there. Or actually, like the London case I ran into this week, where one of our clients is from Canada, and the date set up in their server, instead of a slash that separates the month and day and year, in their case, they have a dash. And of course, that broke our generation of a wallet that they used for SAM authentication. I had to fix that too. And it's just because there's little minor differences. Taking people away from being snowflakes and being identical snowflakes. As much as possible, with only a little bit of differences.
One thing I wanted to add today, which has nothing to do with this conversation, but
that's perfectly fine. Let's go on to something that's more exciting.
This blew me away, and it's not. It is not going to be that exciting, but it blew me away today. I was sitting there working on trying to figure out some Varnish code. Have you ever used Varnish? Anybody here use Varnish?
Never heard of it.
Varnish is a caching technology.
It's a little more than a caching technology, but it's mostly billed as the Varnish Cache Server. So one of the company's services that we employ, Fastly, uses Varnish as essentially is what they provide that as their services, their version and their tools around Varnish and their service. And my wife comes downstairs and she's all animated and chatty on the phone with somebody. And she's like, yes, my husband would love to talk to you. And apparently, apparently somebody from the Charlottesville, Virginia Unemployment Commission or the Virginia Employment Commission called my wife to help Paige, I don't know how the wires got crossed, with a problem that she was having, which wasn't actually her problem, it was her boyfriend's problem. Her was having problems, but ended up calling my wife, and then my wife said, no, I'm not having a problem, but my husband is. And then this woman proceeded to help me with all the problems that I've had trying to file the unemployment for my two furloughs.
Oh boy.
And I was just like, I had almost given up on this, right? Because I couldn't get anybody through the website. I couldn't find it. She gave me all the information I need. She said, here, you call this phone number, you use this option, and then you file your weekly claim. She says, if you have any problems, you call this phone number, you use this option, and you do this at 8:15 in the morning, Tuesday through Friday, because if you try and do it Monday, it's too insane. And you call them, and you keep calling, and you get everybody and your family to keep calling them, and you're going to get through to a voicemail box that says, we are busy right now, please leave your name and number and we'll call you back. And she says, and they will call you back, and then you will work through whatever problems you have. You could do it on a Saturday too, but it doesn't open till 9 o'clock, so just be aware at 8:15. She gave me all these tips. She then said, when you're filling out this part of the thing for the weekly, here's the answers to the questions that you want to use, because it's really confusing, like questions they ask you. When I was on furlough, it was like,
are you sure this isn't a scam?
No, it wasn't a scam. And she's like, when, you know, because you're on furlough, you the question that asks you, they ask you is, if you were accepted a job, would you take it? And it's like, well, no, if you were accepted a job, could you take it? Could you accept employment at this time? Well, technically I could, but I wouldn't, because I'm going back to work the following week. So what's the answer, the right answer? It's always yes. And she's like, and it's weird, you know, the way that they ask these questions. And she says, we understand this is the case for you. It's a little different, but just answer it this way and we understand how it is. And then I thanked her. And she was like, that's fine. That's what we're here for. And that was it. And then I went and I learned that I actually did get paid unemployment for that week, although we didn't notice it. And we thought we didn't get it, but we did. She told me the exact date it went in. We double checked it was there. And then she said, the weird thing is because I was on furlough, technically what I should have done was the week that I was on furlough, that next week when you do the filing for that week, you open the unemployment claim and then you file your first claim. And then I should keep filing each week after that, even though I'm working until the next furlough. And then I put in for that and then keep working. What I had done is I filed for that week and didn't go back. And then when I went back to file again, thinking I had not gotten it, that I should go back and try and refile again, but I couldn't do that. It would only let me file for the next week, which I wasn't on furlough, so I didn't know what to do. So I reopened the claim for my next furlough. So when I went in to do the unemployment claim,
the weekly claim, it started me from that next furlough. And then she's like, whatever you do, just keep doing it, because if you go on furlough again, you're either going to have to reopen your claims, or if you just keep doing it, if you know you're going to end up there. So it's really, it's kind of a weird situation. And then I ran into another problem where they're like, when I filed the weekly claim, like the first one I filed that I was back to work, said, did you accept, did you accept payment for employment or self-employment? And I said, yes. And you have to enter how much you did. And then it said, did you go back, you know, did you return to work in this week? And if so, what day did you return to work? So the week after my furlough, I was able to put in the week I returned to full employment. Now the week after that, the question was the same. It said, did you return to full employment this week? So yes, I did. What was the date you returned to full employment? Well, I returned to full employment the week before, but it wouldn't let me use that date. So that gets really weird right there, because I don't know how to answer that question properly for whatever it is they're looking for. So I just said yes, and I put it in for the Monday of that week. I don't know. It was crazy, but I was blown away that someone just called us and out of the blue, nothing related to me. So bravo for them and that lady. I'm very thankful. Money, 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 Joel. Money.
Sure.
Crazy.
Varnish. Woo, I got to write tests for Varnish now. And Jenkins. Mm-hmm. And Jenkins. I had to use a Git submodule to include it into another page, another Git repository. Oh, you're going to learn all sorts of stuff with Git, Joel. You're going to love it.
Mm-hmm.
Forking and branches and upstream. And then when you accidentally commit something to the master branch and have to get it out of there, roll it back so that it doesn't fuck up your CI environment. Oh, that's a joy. Mm-hmm. That is a joy. I love it.
Yep.
Right, Joe?
That.
Okay.
He said right. Yeah. I had to buy my wife a new laptop this week.
Oh, yeah. What did you get her?
I can't. It's
Shut
her
up,
work.
How dare
Come
you?
Come on.
On a Linux show?
I'd love it. I'd love it if she could, but no. No, but I'm going to put Linux on her old one. Ha ha. Which still works. I'm pretty sure still works. Her old one, I upgraded the RAM in it, so it has 12 gigs in it, but it still wasn't enough. And I just realized how old her system was. And when I told her that, she's like, well, I think I want a new one now. And I'm like, okay. We got her a Lenovo IdeaPad, and I'm trying to remember the actual model number. But it actually has an NVIDIA card in it. It has, I believe it's 8 gigs of RAM and a 512 gig SSD.
Is it the Yoga?
Drive. No, it's an IdeaPad. It's not a Yoga. It doesn't flip over. It doesn't have a touchscreen. It's also 17 inches, and it's less than 1080p.
What's the graphics card? You said it's got an NVIDIA graphics card in it, so
yeah.
It's an IdeaPad, but it's marketed as a gaming machine?
Nope. It's not marketed as a gaming machine. Although, I almost did get her a gaming machine because they actually had a really good deal on, I think it was an Asus ROG laptop for like $800.
That is a good deal.
Yeah, it was scary. It was a scary good deal because they had like a 1060 card in it. It was wild. But, no, they were out of stock, so. I have to see if I can find them full model number. It's a Core i5, probably the fastest one she's ever had. Although I debate whether it's faster than anything I have. So, but you know, my favorite was, you know, walking her through how to fix things. Like one of the things, like she uses the F1 key a lot for her work. Well, that also happens to be the key that mutes the speaker on the laptop. So I had to figure out how to flip it so that in order to do that, you have to press the FN key instead of hit the FN key to hit F1. Because Lenovo, they're morons with that. tried to talk her into. There was a different one that was right around the same. This one was probably about 600, I think. There was other ones that were right around the same price range that were 15 inches and full 1080p, but she wanted the bigger screen, and I'm like, and it was like nah, blah. I forget. It's an odd resolution. And the guy at the thing says, well, 17 inches don't have 1080p displays because of their ratio. I'm like, you're bullshitting. That's what I wanted to tell him. That's not what I told him, though. And then the guy's like, well, you want to add another year of Office 365? Or actually, it's Microsoft 365 now. They changed the name of it.
Did you tell him you didn't even want the first year? Get out of here.
No, I told him I already had that. It's like, I don't want to, you know, because basically you can add another year onto what you already have. But I'm like, but when does that mean? I already have it set so we know when it comes out, you know, when that's going to happen. Because she wants Office, whatever. I don't really care on my stuff, but. Although I do use it on, yeah, I do have it on my Windows machines that I have. But it's like, no, I don't need it. I don't need it. I already have it. I don't need it. He's like, are you sure it's a really good deal? It was the same price as I was paying as a yearly price already. So I'm like, it's not, no. Go away. Go away. Get my laptop.
Spectrum offering me the special deal every couple of weeks just for me. That's the exact same price that it's been for the last 6 months that they've been offering it to me.
Exactly.
Why haven't you taken advantage of it?
Because I don't want cable, know, and right? It would slow down my internet speed.
They want you to have the best experience, Joe.
Yes, they want me to have slower internet and then cable TV that I don't watch.
Right.
Well, maybe now you will.
No.
No.
We gotta wrap this up, huh?
Oh, one nifty thing that her new laptop has that none of the ones I have. It has a built-in privacy thing over the webcam. Which I'm like, yeah, that's about time.
What does it do? Just have a little...
It's a physical slide that goes over the lens on the camera.
Huh.
It's built right into the frame of the laptop, so it's not like stuck on or bolted on.
It's actually an X-ray lens. You slide it over.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, and the fingerprint reader, too. It's on the power button.
Interesting.
No, I want to say hers is the IdeaPad 3 17-inch Intel, I think. Yes, it's 1600 by 900 display. So they call it HD Plus, which is not that at all, but 8 gigs of RAM. It says 8.5 hour battery, which I doubt.
That's if you don't use it and just let it sit there idly, right?
Right. And this, the website, maybe it's not the 3, because the website says it has a Core i3, but I swear it says it has a Core i5 sticker on it, and I looked and it was a Core i5. Yeah, so that may be not the right one, but it's close to it. Because with her, it's all about the touchy-feelies. If it had been me, I would have ordered one on Amazon, and we would have had it the next day anyway. So we had to go to Micro Center and look at it. While I was there, though, I did notice they had a desktop that had that you can buy that already had the water cooling all done on it. Gaming system. Actually, if I was looking at a desktop now, there's a Corsair system I'd really like to get.
What would you go for specs?
The one they have, the Corsair One Pro, which is a compact workstation PC. It's got an RTX 2080 Ti.
Yeah, going top end there.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, but as right? much as I want one, it's a i9 64 gig of RAM.
The budget build right now is the Ryzen 5 3600 and the, what is it, the 1660 and the NVIDIA GTX 1660. And after you toss in the motherboard and 16 gig of RAM, you're looking between 500 and 650.
There's the one. In fact, actually, if you see that one, I just dropped it in the IRC. I don't know if that's there was Jace Two Cents. He took that same case, which I don't know. I think the case is also available separately, and he built like a Star Wars build out of that. Painted it and all that. It had like Imperial logos on it and everything. Red lights on the side. Yeah, I don't even have room to put one of these in my office, so. And I definitely don't want to put them in here now because this air conditioning being out sucks. Hopefully they can fix it tomorrow, because I don't want to have to try and finance a new air conditioning, because that's what I'd have to do in order to get a new HVAC system in here. I'd rather get it working now and then start shopping for one so that we can save and get the one we want, not the one we can afford, you know. There's the one you can afford, and then there's the one you want. And you'd rather have, especially in your house, when you're probably doing it one time, period, after the one you built the home around goes out, you know? The odds of you doing that, me doing that again before we move out of this place, is going to be slim to none if we have to replace it. So this will be the one shot. So it's like I'd rather do it the way I want to than having to do it when I have no choice.
We got to wrap this up, man. You're looking
at least $10,000 to $15,000, at least.
We got to wrap this up. I got to get going.
Yes, we do. Me too.
All right. Want to thank everybody. Have a great week. Safe week. Thank you, Joe. I'll see you on Sunday, Joe.
Yep.
You will see me on Sunday, Joe, and be thankful for that.
I'll see you online.
Yeah. Yes. I look forward to it. I'm going to play the promo.
Did you want to jump on Saturday for a few minutes just to meet the team, get everything in good working order?
What time on Saturday?
Usually... about the same time, about 3.
Oh, come on, Joe. I got so much going on in my own yard, huh? Yeah, that's not a problem.
It'll give you a good excuse to skip out on the yard work.
I can't skip out on the yard work. That's my pride and joy, my pleasure, Joe. That's all I have left. Come on.
Actually, I had to start paying somebody to do my yard work. It hurts too much.
Well, that stinks.
Yeah, I know.
Can you shoot me an email about Saturday, too? Just a reminder.
I did. I included that in the email.
Oh, you did? I guess I didn't read the email.
Joe got his haircut, too.
You got your haircut or all of them cut?
I got more than one of them cut.
There you go.
You got your beard trimmed, too. All of them.
Yeah, I trimmed the beard.
Now, did you do the haircut or did you go somewhere?
I went somewhere and got a haircut.
Okay, so you had to wear a mask, yeah.
Yeah.
Living life on the edge. All right, I got to play this.
And meanwhile, Dan looks like an Amish man.
He's proud of it. Alright, I'm gonna play us out. Here is I'll see you on Saturday.
Good night.
Here we go.
Good night.
Your promos.
Hello, my name is Matt, and I've started a new podcast called LibreQuest and talk about Linux and general technical topics. To get the show, visit LibreQuest.org.
Hi, folks, this is Chatter. Gay Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Oh my God,
it's Hacker
Public Radio.
Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
While you were making egg poo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
I found more hand sanitizer this week. Woohoo!
There you go.
Never name brand Purell. It's always like Joe's hand sanitizer. Or the most generic bottle looking bottle ever.
Oh, I gotta go to the bathroom. Everybody wants to know that, huh?
Sure. All right, let's see if I can find a cooler room than this one.
Well, good luck. I hope you get everything sorted out on that. That's not.
I do too, man. Ugh.
Stay cool. If you can.
Ha ha ha.
Have a good one, man.
Well, what's not down is the temperature in my house.
Uh-oh, is your air conditioner on the fritz?
Yeah, they're coming tomorrow.
That's not
fun. I hope they fix it. It's not, we got up to 90 degrees in here today, but we did have the storm roll through, so.
Man, that's when you lay in the bathtub.
That's when you want to lay in the bathtub, but you can't because you got to work.
Oh, yeah, there's that, too. Do you have fans or anything?
Yeah, I got one running right. I got actually my window cracked open now that it's finally colder outside. It's like 77, according to my Echo Show out there. We had a good storm roll through not all that long ago.
It was nice and cool today.
What's nice and cool down there, 90?
I don't know. What's the temperature been today? Becky? What's the temperature been today? 88. So, yeah, 90.
Yeah. I Actually, I think I'll see if I can put my laptop so I can get a little bit closer to the fan, but not too close.
It's going to be 98 next Tuesday.
Not this Tuesday, but the following, or this coming up Tuesday?
This coming up Tuesday.
And it's supposed to be in the 70s the rest of the week here. Can you hear the fan? I'm actually got my head practically in it.
No.
Okay. It's on the other side of the fan then, so.
But don't forget about this weekend, Dan.
Oh.
What's this weekend?
That's right. That's Sunday?
Sunday, yeah.
Yes.
Nice. Hey, gosh.
Okay, let's see.
That's okay. We went out to eat tonight because it's so freaking hot in the house. I went to O'Charlie's.
Did, you didn't send me the information, or is there information?
I need to give you the information.
Okay. So you're just going to, what, email it to me?
Yeah. Hold on. Let me do that right now while I'm thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What's your email address?
You could just use danns23@gmail.com. You can actually that or dann@thelinuxlink.net. Either one.
danns23@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Terrific. Excuse me. Yep, went to O'Charlie's and I had a club sandwich. Lots of distance between the tables. No feeling unsafe or nothing. It was pretty good. And much cooler than my house is, even after the storms rolled through. Yeah, I got the 90 degrees inside my house this week. They're out Tuesday for the initial one, but we still had it running. And he said the coils were frozen and it had to melt before they could, you know, put the gauges on it and see if there's any. But I'm almost guarantee you there's something going on with it right now. Because I did turn it on for a little bit last night after they came yesterday, and I didn't really feel like it was getting cold, so cause I left it run for about an hour because I was desperate. Cause,
what time is it right now, Dan?
My time 8:31.
Okay, thank you.
Why are you trying to do the time conversion? You're like 2 hours ahead, right?
Hour.
No, I mean, 1 hour. And only an hour behind?
Yes, correct.
Where is the dividing line? I forget. Is it around Phoenix?
No. No, Central is starts around Indian, like
No, Mountain Time.
Mountain Time, it's probably what?
Phoenix.
Yeah.
Because, like, I always think, like, Mountain Time is closer,
more east
than it actually is.
Mm-hmm. Everyone seems to think that Columbus is in Central, even though it's well, in the Eastern time zone, there's at least another state or so to the west of us that's still Eastern. Although Indiana doesn't have a daylight savings. So I think right now Indiana and Ohio are at the same time, if I remember right.
There. I sent you an email.
One stack is...
Yo.
Yes.
What's up, big man?
Hey, you oh, hey. Yo, how's it going, man? Hey, Jonas.
Jonas.
Yeah, Jonas, the guy's not even on the show. Oh. Say hey.
Oh, do I have to greet all you guys first? Hey, Joe.
Oh, I thought you were calling Joe.
Hey, Joe.
You're peeking.
Hi,
man.
Dan.
Dude, back off the mic, man. Quit eating it.
Turn your gain down.
Yeah, you're blowing us out.
Hey, I got it.
Yeah, Joe, so we're good.
Well, Jonas is in there now. Mini PC show that are practically anti 8 gig Raspberry Pi. I keyed. Well, I had to buy my wife a new laptop this week. More because she, I think it's more because she wanted one, not that she really needed one. But I'm going to go downstairs tonight and grab her old
testing
one after
one,
the show.
Testing 1, 2, 3, is this better?
A little bit.
Yeah. This
serious?
This...
Only a little? I pulled it down
only
50%.
A little.
Well, wow, if, okay. if you talk normally, it's probably fine, but it's...
Joe, are you making fun of me? Are you just trying to get me down, pulled down to 0%?
No, I'm actually telling the truth. You still have some... it's not tinniness. It's like some reverberation or something. That's really horrible.
Yeah. It's just a little bit peaky. Just turn the gain down just a tad more.
It's
a
either
lot.
Your gain or you're using a really terrible mic that you've never used before.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on a second. I got a new headset now. Is this better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might want to turn the gain back up a little bit.
What?
Or just put the mic closer to your mouth, one of the two. Yeah, a week from Sunday, I got the first little camping journey of the season. And we're going to go to Burt Oak State Park.
All right, so how's this doing?
That's
it
good.
Sounds clear.
Okay, good. Hey, Joe, I got to compliment you. I ordered, you know, that board. I didn't do anything with it yet, but apparently I got 5 of those boards.
Yeah.
I'm like, I got a 5-pack. You know, and you break them off like Chiclets or whatever you break them off.
Yeah, when I ordered, I got a 2-pack, but I think I did it from Amazon because I wanted it next day.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll tell you what, eBay is much better than AliExpress. Like, if you find something you want on AliExpress, go over to eBay, see if you can get it, like, as opposed to, like, the 2.5-month wait.
Yeah, so from China right now, you're still looking at, on a lot of things, a month to a month and a half wait.
Oh, bullshit. And I don't get stuff that quick. The last couple of things were, like, easy 10 weeks.
From eBay?
Oh, no. From AliExpress.
Well, that's what I was saying. With eBay, there still is a way.
I got them in
ordering
a couple
from China. Was it a U.S. shipper? I try to usually find U.S. shippers
I ordered last Wednesday, you know, while I was on the show, and I got it Monday.
There you go.
Have you used it yet?
Nah. It's just sitting here. I've got a whole bunch of stuff going on. And actually, I really wanted to talk to Jonas.
So you're here to talk to Jonas?
Yeah. Actually, it's just kind of a happy coincidence he's here. So I on my ANET, I printed an E3D carriage, and I've just got to heat cycle it and torque it up, and then I'm going to put it on and run it. So I'm going to have an E3D hot end on my ANET.
Nice.
Yeah, I was having issues with the hot end, and nothing that I don't have the parts to fix, but I'm like, if I'm going to tear it down, I might as well just replace it.
Did you get my email?
Did you send me an email, and I didn't get it?
Yeah,
I told you I got it.
Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't remember. Like, I paid attention when you told me something. God.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it?
Here, I'm going to send you another one with the show notes so you can add your bi-weekly wanderings to it.
Whoa, there's too many emails from you. I'm going to have to flag you for spam.
Uh-huh. Both my emails.
You could just send it from Facebook Messenger, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Enid's Bowden, I think.
Well, no, the I have an E3D direct drive setup.
Oh, okay.
Well, we should start the show before you start talking about this stuff. Yep. There's a show? You're supposed to say there's a show?
There's a show? I'm going to bring back the like list of words that we got to say every show.
Yeah, but we haven't heard Joel saying in a while.
We have to say
there's the turbos.
Silk Road. Porn.
You haven't pissed Joel off enough in a while, Rich.
Really? Oh, that'll take 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
I actually won a car in auction in Ohio, and I'm having it delivered to Joel's house, and I'm going to put it on blocks in his driveway.
Yeah, then that shit don't bother me no more.
But I did get you to say shit.
Nah. Too easy.
Joel, did your air conditioner freeze up because it was off for a bit and then turned back on? Was that it, or is it?
Well, as talking to the tech, there's two reasons why that might happen. One is just lack of circulation through the fan, through fins and stuff, and both that inside and the outside part. Which when they came earlier, like in May, yeah, it's only been since then, since I had them out the first time, all they did was clean out the condenser and tell me, replace your furnace filter, which I've been doing it like every 2 weeks now, just because we've been doing so much work around the house, where I've got most of the painting is complete on the walls now. Just got some stuff to do on the ceiling downstairs and stuff. But anyway, so that's one reason. The other reason is it could be low on Freon. So, and they couldn't, and when it was frozen,
couldn't they know that?
Well, he told me when it was frozen up like that, they couldn't measure the pressures because the pressures would be too low anyway. It would measure lower than it actually is. So he had to turn it off. So it's been off since yesterday. So, and it got to 90 degrees here in the house. So it's down to about 88 since the storms rolled through. So, and I got the fans going, the windows open, so hopefully it'll get a little bit more comfortable, but they're not due till tomorrow until the afternoon, but we're supposed to be below 80 all day tomorrow, so. But I'm just hoping, I'm hoping that they can fix it at least for another year, but, you know, that unit's over 20 years old, so it's going to need replaced at some point. So, and I just don't want to finance it's probably between $10,000 to $15,000 to put a new HVAC system in. I'll do it if we have to, though. But we shall see. We'll see what the man says tomorrow.
The man!
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get this rolling here.
No way to replace the battery in Luke's car this last week, too.
How old was the battery?
Doesn't matter.
It was probably original, but it had a bad cell on it, so.
Oh.
Dude, I hate to say it, batteries don't last for crap anymore.
No. They don't. And they're also a whole lot more expensive now, too.
Holy Christmas! Yeah, what'd you pay for the battery?
$240 installed.
Installed? What do you mean installed? You can't install a battery.
I can install a battery, but there's other things wrong too, so I had him do all of it at once. All of it wasn't that much more than that, to be honest.
You know, if you go to Pep Boys, they'll put the battery in for you.
Right, but the battery itself was already 220, so they didn't charge me a whole lot to put it in, dude.
Oh, they only charge you $20?
I'm thinking like that. Well, I didn't have much choice. They said normally
holy
it would
crap,
have...
$220 for a battery.
I yeah, remember when they were like cheap. $40-$50.
Yeah, I did.
And that was like a 1970 Oldsmobile, you know?
Right. I do too, but nowadays, I think that most of them have to have a higher amperage.
I was shocked.
Capable of producing more amps. It's expensive. It really is.
I don't think the battery in my Genesis was 2 years old and it went dead. You know, it was under warranty, but I was like, what? Serious? I couldn't believe it went dead. You know, my wife's like, I think your battery's dead. I'm like, no, I'm sure it's not the battery. Yep, it was the battery.
Yeah, I had to have them look at the TPM sensor in one of the tires, too, because it started acting up as well. So they looked at that. Luckily, I think on that one, it was probably just some dirt in the sensor. So,
there's no dirt in the sensor?
Yeah, there could be dirt in the sensor, dude.
You don't get dirt on the inside of your tire. Unless you're doing it wrong.
Or unless they... you know, the dealership has stuff in their air. Who knows? I don't know.
They have dirt in their air?
Or oil or whatever, you know?
Yeah, usually those things are like if they warm up, they're okay. I mean, did the snow melt for you yet?
Dude, we hardly had any snow last year. And it would be well melted by now anyway. It was melted back in March, if they had any.
Alrighty, so we starting the show, or Dan, are you like writing the music? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm writing the music.
Yeah.
No, I just we're waiting for the car talks to park itself in the garage.